This is August 27th, 2004, and I'm visiting with Ken Miracle of the School for Workers to interview him for the oral history of the Institute. And he's been involved in various ways, and we thought it would be good to have his comments. So, Ken, welcome. I'm delighted that you're willing to participate in this activity. And why don't you tell us a little bit about your educational background, and I think the fact that you got your PhD here in the program.
Mm-hmm. I finished high school in Western Canada in Alberta and came to the United States in 1962. Attended Iowa State University where I studied industrial engineering. As an undergraduate, I took a couple of courses from a man named Ed Jakubauskas. Ed was a student of Gerald Summers at the University of Wisconsin. I got quite interested in economics, particularly in labor economics, and I studied for a master's degree with Ed Jakubauskas and Harold Davy at Iowa State University, and started a PhD program in economics, and decided basically that I was more interested in institutional economics, I guess, and industrial relations, and decided to apply to the PhD program at the University of Wisconsin. Jakubauskas encouraged me and I think contacted Summers on my behalf and certainly wrote letters for me and everything. I ended up at the University of Wisconsin starting in 1969 bringing a master's degree in economics and entering the PhD program. And I was in that program from 1969 until 1973, at which time I finished my coursework and was mostly finished with my dissertation. At that point, I took a job at the Sloan School of Management at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where I worked as an assistant professor from 1973 to 1979. And then at that point, I came back to the University of Wisconsin for a position at the School for Workers. And I've been on the faculty of the School for Workers from 1979 until the present. I served as director from 1992. Until 2002 for that 10-year period. And so for the last 2 years, I have been a regular professor of labor education in the School for Workers. That's a little more than you asked for.
Well, no, that's all very helpful. Can you tell us a bit more about your experience here as a grad student in industrial relations?
Yes. As I said, I came in 1969, and the university was a very exciting place. I mean, the intellectual environment was really stimulating at that time. And that was true for the university in general. It was also true in industrial relations. The level of faculty interest in industrial relations was very high. There were a number of people in the economics department who were most influential, I would say, but there were a lot of active people from different departments around the campus. There's a large PhD program, and the students were very active. And I think that's what was probably most exciting about it, that there was a regular student seminar, PhD seminar, where people were meeting, talking about their research. Of course, the university was in turmoil over politics, and many of the graduate students in the program were actively involved in the anti-war movement and various other social movements. So there was a real interesting intellectual climate. And of course, there were also disruptions. When I was a graduate student it would be the summer of, 70 or 71, Kent State incident occurred on the Madison campus. In the same semester, there was a teaching assistant strike, and then the invasion of Cambodia occurred, and I may be screwing up my dates a little bit, but there's all kinds of interesting, serious political activity on the campus, which I think added to the excitement. In some ways, I believe, although I may not have a complete historical perspective on this, but in some ways, I think this was kind of the peak period intellectually for the for industrial relations. The fact that we had so many people involved in many different areas. I mean, there was Jerry Summers, yourself, and others who were working in what we called manpower in those days and later became employment and training. a large group of people there. There were a lot of people in unions and collective bargaining. There were a number of people in international and comparative, and of course a large contingent in human resource development and organizational behavior. And interestingly, all those groups came together. Mm-hmm. And I suppose it was the general climate in the university that really brought us all together. I think that began to break down in later years. People kind of compartmentalized more. Mm-hmm. But at that time, everybody was kind of together.
Who would you say were some of the most influential faculty in your own intellectual development?
Well, that's interesting. It was really, I would say, kind of a mix of people. In among the people with a close association with industrial relations, I would say Everett Caslow, Jack Barbash, Tom Skidmore in history, Dick Miller, Saul Levine, a number of people who were interested in international and comparative. I did my PhD research in Brazil, and so my field was international and comparative industrial relations. Jerry Summers passed away fairly early on in my graduate career. I think probably in the winter of 1970 or 71.
Actually, it was 1977.
No kidding.
Yeah, that's right.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Well, then I had so kind of distanced, separated myself from Jerry, and I guess probably because, originally I had come here with an assistantship in employment and training on a project that he was doing in South Asia,
right.
And later on I drifted more into an interest in Latin America and economic development in general, and the role of labor in economic development, and so I guess I drifted away from Jerry a bit, but. Yeah, so those folks outside of industrial relations, I did a lot of coursework in sociology, and worked with a number of people there: Gene Havens, Marie Seidlin, Bob Alford, and I think was influenced. There was an interesting program in those days called the Sociology of Economic Change, and it was a sort of Marxist, at least it looked both at Marxist and mainstream literature on economic development. I found that very interesting, very stimulating. So those were my intellectual mentors, I would say. I'm sure I'm missing something.
Well, but mention. No, this is very good. Then you went to MIT, and what happened there? How would you describe that experience?
Well, I left, I did my PhD research in Brazil, and so I had an ongoing interest in the problem of labor and economic development. When I got to MIT, I developed a relationship with, my appointment, of course, was in industrial relations, industrial relations section of the Sloan School. And it was an interesting time to be there. Mike Peori was doing a lot of interesting work. Charlie Myers was still in the faculty at that point. Abe Siegel was an associate dean. But regularly sat in on our faculty seminars. We had a seminar, a weekly seminar, in which faculty would talk about research, or talk about research that they were thinking about doing, or report on some of their recent activities. And it drew the faculty from MIT, but it also drew people from Harvard, from Northeastern, from Boston College, so we had a string of visitors, very interesting kind of ongoing activity. And Dunlop, for example, would come down once or twice a year and pontificate and tease everybody. And, and that was always interesting. Mm-hmm. And Paul Osterman was at that time either at Northeastern or Boston University, I don't remember which, but he'd come over, and so it was interesting. Mm-hmm. I taught in the Sloan School. There was a required course in labor relations in those days. I'm sure there probably isn't anymore, but this was about the time when business schools were dropping their requirements in labor relations, the beginning of the end, at least as far as the business community is concerned, the beginning of the end of the labor movement. But we still had a required course. And a lot of the students were not particularly interested in labor relations, but they were smart, they could write good papers, and if you gave them something to chew on, they would usually kind of respond. And so it was a pretty interesting teaching environment. I also had seminars in more narrowly focused fields in international comparative industrial relations. So it was for me, it was a very stimulating environment. It was, you know, I have humble roots, and to end up in an elite institution like this, a place that I didn't even know existed when I was in high school, to end up teaching there was an interesting experience. The difference between Wisconsin and Cambridge that really struck me was that the faculty were really plugged into the Washington, New York, Boston power structure out there in ways that that were not here in the Midwest. And you know, I never got plugged into that structure, but it certainly was interesting to be around it. Very stimulating.
Yeah, and your colleague Tom Kolkin is obviously
he's plugged in.
Very well.
Tom's success at MIT has been phenomenal and well deserved.
Yeah, who are some of your compatriots
from that
students?
Time period? Yeah, well, you mentioned Tom. Right. Stu Schmidt, who ended up at Temple University, Tom Dakotas went to Cornell University. Let me see, George Ogle was here. George was involved in with the Christian churches in Korea, helping to helping a labor movement to survive in that country, I would say, and he came back and did a PhD. Myron Rumkin. Myron's now a dean at, or was a dean recently at Kellogg in, at Northwestern University. Gee, I'm undoubtedly forgetting lots and lots of people. But anyway, those are the types of folks.
Tom Barucci?
Barucci ended up having faculty positions in a number of institutions in the Boston area and having a pretty successful consulting career there.
And did you know Carl Schramm?
Sure did.
He's head of this Kauffman Foundation now, dealing with entrepreneurship in Kansas City or something.
Carl's an interesting guy. Carl was sort of a groupie with the teaching assistants when he was here. It was kind of he went to, I think, a Jesuit institution as an undergraduate.
That's
and
right.
He struck me as being somewhat naive and. Yeah. But enthusiastic, and he's done very well.
Yes.
Yeah. He had a number of important administrative positions in university and foundation.
That's right. Yeah.
Leadership positions.
Done very well. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then you came back here, and then you came into the School for Workers.
Yes.
Was this a big shift for you?
It was certainly a career change. Yeah. You know, intellectually, there's a fair amount of continuity, but. You know, I went from teaching elite students in a business school, in one of the country's best business schools, to teaching steward training in Ladysmith, Wisconsin. I think the faculty here, when they were considering making me an offer, had some serious reservations on grounds that, you know, they probably thought I was doing field work and would leave and be dissatisfied and leave. And I think the main reason that they made me an offer is because I had the bachelor's degree in industrial engineering. And the department, the School for Workers, had a history of performing both training and a service role for the labor movement as a whole in this area. So they were looking for some way to continue that expertise. Yeah. And that's why they made the offer. And in fact, I've done a lot of that since I've been here. So it was a major kind of shift. But frankly, it was one that suited me, you know, given my background and everything. I don't think I was really ambitious enough to succeed at an elite institution in terms of doing what you need to do to be successful at a place like that. I found it very stimulating, very interesting, but never felt like I fit all that well. And I got to say that I have never had those kind of feelings about being here.
Okay.
So it was for me, it was almost from the time that I got back, I felt pretty comfortable. And interestingly enough, at that point, I was able to kind of revive my entire academic career and all the previous training that I had. So, for example, I got back into doing quite a bit of work in industrial engineering. Mm-hmm. And that opened a lot of doors for me in the labor movement, mm-hmm. because it's an area where they need outside expertise. And, I was pretty good at it. Mm-hmm. So I was able to work with, at this point in my life, I worked with, I would say, all of the important large unions in the country. Mm-hmm. And that's, that gave me a kind of credibility that I otherwise would not have had, since I, you know, typically at the School for Workers, the job candidate would be somebody who worked in a staff position or a research department or somewhere else in the labor movement. And I didn't bring that. I certainly brought an interest and I brought a mm-hmm. commitment, but I didn't bring that kind of experience. But what I did bring was a certain technical expertise and I think some other skills that mm-hmm. That I've been able to capitalize on. And I think basically I've been good for the department mm-hmm. over the years. The industrial relations degree was very important.
Mm-hmm.
Just having a general sense of labor relations, industrial relations, and what the labor movement is all about, and how it's structured and how it's governed. That foundation is important for anybody who works in an institution like this.
Mm-hmm. Now, after you got back here, what was your involvement with the IR program?
Yeah, well, from almost...
Let's say the first few years.
Yeah, right from the beginning, I was active as a participating faculty member and active on various committees.
Yeah.
So from the beginning, I would say I was doing things like serving on admissions committees
right.
and financial aid committees. Yeah. And I don't remember exactly when it happened, but fairly early on, I was also invited to be on at the time we referred to as the administrative and the executive mm. committees. They were two separate committees.
Yeah.
The rationale for having two separate committees escapes me at this point, but there were two separate ones. And from that point forward, essentially, I was on the executive
yeah.
committee. So I would say that I've been active at an administrative and committee level in the Institute as long as I've been here.
Mm-hmm.
I never did much teaching in the program because, of course, all the teaching is concentrated in the departments.
Right.
And I've always had a very heavy workload at the School for Workers, so not much time for mm. that. I did some teaching. I taught a course on union administration
mm.
and organizing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was generally pretty well regarded by
mm-hmm.
the students. I also did some summer teaching in a program that Jim Stern was involved in which we brought people from Brazil, people
oh, yes.
from the government sector, from the labor movement, and from
yeah.
the management community that IR sponsored, at least nominally,
mm-hmm.
through Jim.
Yeah.
And of course, I've been involved in the supervision of tutorials,
mm-hmm.
Master's theses, and PhD dissertations
mm-hmm.
over the years. So that's how I would
yeah.
describe my involvement.
How would you describe the Institute when you came back versus when you were here as a student? I realize these are different perspectives,
yeah. Yeah.
but I'm just curious.
Well, of course,
how you saw it.
Let me start with the faculty. The center of gravity had shifted tremendously. The economics department was no longer, I would say, the dominant force in terms of defining the Institute and supporting the Institute. As I saw it, that shift had begun to occur probably from the day that I left the university. When Jerry's generation, and you're a little bit younger,
yeah.
but when that generation started to retire, mm-hmm. that, it seems to me, was the beginning of the end of the dominance of the economics
mm-hmm.
discipline.
Mm-hmm.
So we get the retirement of Barbash,
right.
Caslow, Jerry Summers passed
right.
away, Jim Stern,
right.
And a little bit later, Lee Hansen,
yeah.
Glenn Kane,
yeah.
We end up with a whole generation of people who had been not just important in industrial relations,
mm-hmm.
but also department important in economics
mm-hmm.
at the University of Wisconsin and,
right.
and beyond, and an intellectual shift that's simultaneously occurring within economics, which you know, downplays the importance of institutional economics, and you've heard, you know this, you've thought it through much more carefully than me, but and economic history and so on and so forth. So the new generation doesn't have the same kind of interest, doesn't have the same kind of commitment to industrial relations. So economics is marginalized, and so the basically the shift of the center of gravity is across observatory drive to at least where the business school was located at that point in time, and so. In the business school, I think the people who were most active when I came back were that faculty, and that would have been, I think maybe Saul was still there at the time, just at the end of his career, but more importantly, Don Schwab, Dick Miller, who were the older crew, and then the younger people. And it's been a series of people. Now, the commitment there was not like economics, where it tended to be more sustained. I think what happens with that managed department in the business school is people get interested in industrial relations for a period of time, and then the interest kind of fades. And I put a number of people into that category, like Randy Dunham and Ann Miner, and who had real commitment for a period of time, but it wasn't a central and principal commitment in the same way that it was for you and that earlier generation of, I shouldn't be telling you what your commitments are.
But want to hear your opinion.
Well, that is my opinion. It was central and important to the economist in ways, with a few exceptions, that it is not central and important to the people in the business school. And, you know, that's not true of, in my opinion, of Don Schwab, of Richard Miller, so of that older, slightly older generation. But I think it is true of Anne, Randy, and the younger generation. I don't know as well. I suspect that they're kind of coming back in a way. But back to what? There's nothing to come back to at this point. And there, I'm thinking of Barry Gerhart.
And they've got a couple of other new people.
Chip. Chip has a real intellectual commitment, I think, to the field. The young man whose name I'm blocking, who has a PhD from Cornell.
Travers?
Is that it?
Charlie Travers?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, as I see it, you asked me, the question was, you know, how is it different when I came back? Well, I got carried away with my answer there, but economics declines. And so it becomes, I think, an institute which in which the key players are the people from the business school, and then small clusters from a lot of different departments. A couple of people from the law school, Karen and Jim Weiss brought it in those days, Karen Klaus, one or two people from the economic or from the sociology department. You know, my sense of the sociologists was basically that they were slumming it when they were involved with industrial relations, that the real intellectual activity was somewhere else, and so nevertheless they participated, they worked on committees, they made a real contribution, but intellectually I don't think there was much of with a couple of exceptions. I don't remember if Jonathan Zeitlin was here when I first came back.
No, he came here later. About late.
And Jonathan had a serious commitment almost from day one, I would say.
Now, in about 1985, 86, 87, we hired Craig Olson. We then got Streck. We hired a young guy, Zondervan, who was in history. And then a year or two later, Zeitlin came. Did that have any significance in your view, in how you looked at the institute?
Yeah, potentially, I think it did. We reached out at that point to, we being the School for Workers, to Wolfgang and to Joel Rogers. Who had a serious, both of them had a serious interest in developing ties to the labor movement. But we never were able to put together a kind of partnership with them in terms of both groups approaching the labor movement and working on projects. And it may just have been a difference in outlook or in terms of what the nature of that collaboration, or what the focus of the collaboration could be. Where I thought it might be possible was in the area of what Joel calls the high road, high performance work organization, mm-hmm. where, you know, we had, I would say starting about 1983, 84, when the crisis was occurring in Midwestern manufacturing,
yeah.
big time,
right, yeah.
and the labor movement had lost a lot of membership. I believe it was primarily my leadership at the School for Workers, but I think there was general buy-in. We sort of did an analysis of what we thought was going on in manufacturing and decided that the whole competitive situation had really shifted, yeah. and that American manufacturing was going to have to modernize at that point, and that the labor movement and indeed a lot of the contracts that they negotiated, the rights that they had achieved and the privileges and status that they had achieved was threatened by all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And nevertheless, we did not feel that the correct position was to simply oppose this change, that it was not in the long-term interests of the labor movement, or even in the medium-term interest. So our position was, you have to understand all of this stuff, you have to start to figure out where you're willing to compromise vested rights in the old system, and you have to start figuring out where you need to be in the new system. And so we approached this, I think, primarily from the standpoint of helping the labor movement to understand what this was all about, what the logic of these new production systems were, what the implications were for their existing contract language, and how they needed to change. Now, I think Joel's interest, and I don't know if you're planning to interview them or not, but I think Joel's and Wolfgang's interests were more from the perspective of how do you mesh this with economic renewal, mm-hmm. and what does this mean for training,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. And so these are complementary perspectives, mm-hmm. but we were never able to kind of work out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my sense of that was that partly this was, again, the commanding heights of Bascom Hill looking down, you know,
mm-hmm.
on extension, basically,
mm-hmm.
and on the School for Workers.
Mm-hmm.
I think,
interesting.
Yeah, I think fairly early on they yeah. decided we were Luddites or something like that. That's too strong.
Yeah.
I think they just felt like, you know, we were locked into our old institutional arrangements,
yeah.
and not capable of transcending the
mm-hmm.
constraints, intellectual and organizational.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that was very perceptive,
mm-hmm.
frankly, because we were changing pretty rapidly at that point. And not in terms of our commitment, but in terms of sorting out what our program
right.
mix should be,
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. major internal changes. You
mm-hmm.
know. And we were trying to do it in a strategic way. You know,
mm-hmm.
we were engaging in strategic planning yeah. and really trying to think this through pretty
right.
systematically.
Right.
And we were fairly successful
yeah.
in doing
it. And you were an organization with a mission, and they were kind of freelancers.
Individuals, that's right. That's right. That's
know,
exactly right.
Trying to figure out what
yeah.
they wanted.
And of course, that relates back to industrial relations, and it's part of the problem with
mm-hmm.
industrial relations. And it was, I think, one of the weaknesses of the structure of industrial relations, of the IRRI, in a climate like this, you know, where the basic forces that gave rise to the Institute in the first place are shifting,
yep.
where the labor movement is declining in terms of yep. its political and economic influence, and where the problems that industrial relations, the IRRI was created for in the first place, look like they're solved, you
mm-hmm.
know, at
mm-hmm.
least to the higher-ups in the,
yep.
in the university community. And at that point, there's no group of people who have a mission.
Mm-hmm.
There's no lack of work. There's no lack of issues. I mean, in fact, if anything, the environment is as rich as it's,
mm-hmm.
as it's ever been in the, say, starting in the mid-1980s.
Yeah.
We've got the decline of the labor movement. We've got a major paradigm shift in labor relations
yeah.
in this
yeah.
country going on. So it should have been, in my opinion, a source of great frustration to me. It should have been a period when labor relations scholarship, or I keep saying labor relations, I mean more broadly speaking than that, but where industrial relations scholarship is flourishing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it should have been a golden period of research.
Interesting.
And maybe some people see it that way, but I guess I don't.
Yeah.
And I certainly don't think that the IRI at that point was making major contributions.
Right.
In terms of what should have been a period.
Yeah.
With perhaps a slightly different structure, with more of a sense of mission and a
mm-hmm.
longer-term commitment,
mm-hmm.
and with a kind of organizational structure, which probably meant, you know, being a department with
right, yeah.
an ongoing commitment, that they might have made,
mm-hmm.
should have made. I mean, you know,
mm-hmm.
consider the intellectual history of the university. This is a period like the turn of the century, or the first
yeah.
couple of decades in the century,
yeah.
you know, where we've got an opportunity for major scholarship and to make a major
mm-hmm.
mark on the whole field.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an opportunity missed, in my opinion.
Yeah, interesting. What about this idea of departmentalization? Do you think
yeah.
that would have made a difference?
Well, sure. Absolutely.
You want to elaborate?
Well, sure. I'd love to. Well, for one thing, there would have been a number of people who were drawing their paycheck from
yeah.
the department who had, you know, a serious material interest in the ongoing operations of the department.
Let me stop.
Sure.
And, okay.
So I was so talking about, you know, would it have made a difference
yeah.
if it was a department? And you know, at a purely crass material
mm-hmm.
level, of course it would have made
mm-hmm.
a difference. We would have had a number of people who would have been fighting for the existence
yeah.
of this
yeah.
department. And, you know, one of the sources of great frustration for me when I was trying to fight back in terms of mobilizing students and
mm-hmm.
The labor movement and the outside community in support of the IRRI, was I couldn't find people on the Madison campus, faculty members on the Madison campus, who would make this, you know, a central struggle in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody cared enough about it to kind of step forward and
yeah.
say, and champion the fight. I couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I did what I could do
sure.
in terms of mobilizing the outside communities,
mm-hmm.
but we needed a core of people
right.
on the Madison campus who were willing to, you know, go to the mat on
mm-hmm.
this.
Mm-hmm.
And what we had instead were, you know, three or four people who had a serious commitment to industrial relations and had something to lose. But basically it was a soft landing for them.
Mm-hmm.
Their paychecks didn't disappear the day the place was shut down.
Yeah.
You know, they went on teaching the same courses,
mm-hmm.
Attracting many of the same students,
mm-hmm.
so you know they just didn't have a lot to lose.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it would have made a lot of difference. The other thing is, I think had it been a department earlier on, that some of the things that I was talking about would have occurred before. That we would have had a sort of serious intellectual,
mm-hmm.
Thrust here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think if we had been successful in hiring an outside director. And with the kind of resources that the university originally promised, the ability to hire a couple of
mm-hmm.
people and a couple of key research themes with
right.
more than one faculty member
mm-hmm.
working on a theme, that this could have been turned around pretty rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
The beginning of the end, in my opinion, was the loss of when Aviation decided to pull out.
Oh.
Maybe the end had started earlier than
yeah.
that, but that was an opportunity to turn it around.
Right. Yeah.
It really was.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was extremely frustrating.
Yeah.
I think, you know, my sense of this was that the Dean of Letters and Science was deeply ambivalent about the whole
mm-hmm.
program, and that, you know, when he was confronted with a crowd of people who were interested in advocating, that then he at that point thought, oh, maybe there's something here, maybe we need to rethink this, and so he responds positively, makes commitments,
mm-hmm.
and then he gets back from it, and we have a mini financial crisis, and,
yeah.
and then the thought is, and the pressure's gone away, and then the thought is, well, maybe I was wrong about this before.
Yeah.
And, you know, from my perspective, the administration sabotaged Adrian's candidacy,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know if this is conscious or unconscious, but the way I see it is, you know, they made her an offer with a number of implicit and explicit commitments,
mm-hmm.
and then they failed to live up to those commitments. They backed off on the hiring. They didn't advocate for her tenure in the way
yeah.
that they easily could have. And so basically, they made it impossible for her to
yeah.
come. And then after that, you know, then The answer that we get back from them is that the faculty are not interested, that they can't hire an outside person. Nobody is interested in coming and taking over this field. Well, there's a kind of self, you know, what do I want to say? They talk as though they had no role in creating the situation. You know, there's a dishonesty in that I found appalling at the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other thing is, time passes.
Yeah.
So you have the new generation of administrators coming in, and then they have a different style. And I don't think we had anybody who appreciated the role of labor economics, industrial relations in the history of this university.
Yeah.
It's absolutely appalling.
Yeah. And then we lost Craig and Paula.
Yes.
So then we're down almost nothing.
That's right.
Yeah.
Craig and Paula would have been two additional people who had serious commitment.
Yeah.
Okay. Not that paycheck commitment, but certainly they would have gone to bat for it.
Yeah.
And so the number of people with that level of commitment, you know, had shrunk to the point that we were really vulnerable.
Yeah.
So it's the combination of the administration allowing the institute to atrophy, and to disappear, and occasionally, I think, sabotaging efforts to rebuild it. That combined with the institute reaching a point where it's highly vulnerable in terms of participation of faculty and in terms of the numbers of people who have a serious commitment to the institute. But you know, if there were nobody here, it still would have been a mistake to nobody with that kind of commitment. It still would have been a mistake to close the place down. I mean, objectively, I think you can say that there are all kinds of important research issues here.
Mm-hmm.
That even if the original rationale for the institute has diminished, disappeared, that we need to take a longer-term perspective on these things. I don't really believe that the labor movement is never going to revive in this country. And you know what's going to happen when it does revive? Somebody's going to scratch their head and say, what should we be doing about this? Some high administrator. They're going to say, what should we be doing about this? How should we set up a research center, or should we, you know, how should we be responding to this? Well, I mean, that's what I'm talking about when I say that this was a very, very short-sighted decision.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, my perspective is that the pressures to do this will come back at some point in the future, and that the reasons for doing it continue to exist. There still is a very rich research environment. There's a market for the graduate students, for the graduates of the program. There's no question about that. Nobody denied that.
Yeah.
You know, the response we got from the administration was, we don't do applied degrees. Well, put simply, that's bullshit. They do applied degrees. They've got a huge department, you know, social work department.
Right.
And other departments, La Follette, for crying out loud, the business school, they're all over the place.
Yeah.
Well, in fairness, they're saying letters and science doesn't do that, but even within letters and science, they do it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's phony, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
And so there are plenty of research issues. There's a market, a good market, a better market than there is for most of the other social sciences for the graduates of this program.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I just see the decision as being short-sighted, inconsistent with the intellectual history of the university, something that will be revisited in the future and will be viewed as a mistake historically, and I hope I make a small contribution to that conclusion. Just bad policy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see that you should be responding to short-term operational crises in terms of, you know, butchering important infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Well, the paradox of it is that we've given up this huge comparative advantage we had in labor IR dating back to the turn of the century.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, econ has John Kennan, a labor economist, maybe one or two others, you know, much more narrowly focused, and the whole thing is gone.
Yeah.
What about
and the irony there, of course, is that as far as the world is concerned, you know, it's still the Wisconsin school that made this enormous contribution.
Right.
And most of the world is probably unaware that there's nothing left here
yeah.
to
yeah.
continue that contribution, yeah. although they'll find out soon enough.
Yeah. You know, back in 1977, a departmental status was almost granted.
Yeah.
There was a committee. I guess Bob Lampman was the one who raised questions about
mm-hmm.
it. And, you know, by a narrow vote, they decided not to go ahead. Then
yeah.
in 84, 85, we had that LNS review.
Yeah.
And we were very close. But then Corona didn't seem to be auspicious time to move ahead because environmental studies apparently had been giving degrees and tenure and had no authority. So they were trying to unravel that.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, then, you know, time goes by and you never hear what happens and that chance is gone. And then
yeah.
in the early 90s, we tried again, mid-90s.
Yeah.
Then I think we couldn't make as effective a case as we could earlier. So there were these situations where we, kind of by a narrow vote, so to speak, lost that opportunity. And it always took a lot of force to mobilize to get that.
Right.
Hmm.
You know, I've always wondered about at these particular circumstances how deep the support was for among the faculty, among the active faculty. And, you know, when I look at it purely from the standpoint of take each of the individuals and
mm-hmm.
ask the
yeah,
question,
right.
Do they benefit
right.
or
yeah.
not from this
yeah.
decision? And I think, unfortunately, at each of these junctures, if you did that, you'd find that a lot of the faculty would not benefit from departmentalization status.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
had more prestige in their home departments,
right.
probably better,
right.
I don't know, better privileges, salaries,
yeah.
whatever. And so, you know, I always had the sense that there was a certain play acting going on.
Mm-hmm.
No offense to yourself, because
yeah.
I know you,
no.
and I think this was the solution,
mm-hmm.
but I never could
mm-hmm.
tell in sitting in these meetings
right.
how much actual support. Nobody got up and spoke against
yeah.
it. But I always had the sense
right.
that if not exactly, you know, engaging in a behind the scenes
mm-hmm.
sabotage campaign, at the very least they weren't responding enthusiastically
yeah.
when people, you know, were asking them confidentially,
yeah.
do you support this or not?
Yeah.
And so that was always a sense that I had
mm-hmm.
of what was going on in the background in these
yeah.
In these efforts.
And the paradox of it was that the Barbashes and Castles were in the center of the field when they were hired.
Yeah.
And stayed there.
Yeah.
The rest of us came along and it was not a central focus.
No.
We were kind of on the edges.
Yeah.
And it was hard, I think, to make that move over.
Well, I think that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, there were
yeah.
good reasons.
Yeah.
I'm not saying
yeah.
that these were
yeah.
irrational
no,
positions.
No,
no. But I guess there's a kind of almost inevitability
mm-hmm.
about what happened
mm-hmm.
in a way. I mean, what I'm referring to here is the lack of success of these programs.
Yeah.
You know, I think what it was is people could see this is the right solution for the Institute.
Right.
And so they could get it down on paper.
Yeah.
But then, you know, from their personal perspective, it may
yeah.
not have been the
yeah.
right. And, you know,
yeah.
a lot of the business school faculty fit into that
yeah.
category.
Yeah.
I mean, their salaries, maybe they were
sure.
the principal group, their salaries were a lot higher in the business
yeah.
school
yeah.
than if they had been hired in industrial relations and,
mm-hmm.
and pursued their entire career
mm-hmm.
in industrial relations.
Yeah.
So.
Now, La Follette seems to have made it.
Yeah, I don't know I don't know La Follette well enough. Maybe it's just the
well,
kind of
you know,
direct linkage to the state government.
It was
government.
A kind of Institute for Government Affairs
yeah.
or something.
Yeah.
And then they got some tenure, some budget line.
Yeah.
And then in maybe the early 80s, somehow, there was some big report, and then they got tenure status.
Yeah.
And we didn't. And I gather that's a, you know, very vital organization.
Mm-hmm.
They hire people in their joint appointments.
Yeah.
They own half of them.
Yeah.
And they've got various active programs and all. And I think there's some kind of central focus.
Well, that would have been a good model for,
yeah, it
for IR.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It
you know, it probably has to do with just the timing and the importance of the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
During the period here is a period in which the resources, the percentage
yeah.
of state budget
right.
going to the university
right.
is shrinking.
Yeah. Yeah.
So top administrators are looking at this and probably thinking, we need some ongoing effort.
Well, and IR is easy to cut. You can't cut out economics.
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah, of course
yeah.
that's wrong. Yeah.
So.
You know, my sense of this was if you need to save $300,000, which I think that's the absolute maximum that they could possibly have saved, and I doubt whether they really end up saving anywhere close to that, that maybe we should look at the world's largest sociology department and could cut one or two positions there, you know, if we're interested in saving money.
The paradox of it also was that LNS was paying out $300,000 or whatever it was, but most of it was going to the business school.
You're right, yeah.
Which, and then they were unwilling, I guess, to take it on. Well, without, you know, a nice little backsheesh to go with it.
I think all they were, you know, we were conspiring behind the scenes with the business school faculty. In the end, it looked like the only way to save the place would be to transfer it to the business school.
Mm-hmm.
And so the School for Workers took the position that that was acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were discussing this and trying to put together a viable program. And the idea was keep the same structure.
Yeah.
Just move it across the street so that there is, you know, a home for it and some commitment. And what happened there is interesting. Unfortunately, they were hiring a new dean. And the business school's ratings in the popular press and perhaps elsewhere, but certainly in the, you know, U.S. News and World Report or Business Week or whoever does this, had been declining for a period of time. And the assessment was that they were not paying enough attention to their MBA program, that they had too many of these research centers. And the faculty, of course, loved the research centers because it's serious intellectual activity that's going on in the research centers. So I think the new dean coming in, and maybe it was the mandate that he had, you know, was to kind of clean up this mess and do what you can about it. And so he comes in and virtually from the first day on the job, he's got some of his faculty coming to him saying, look, we want to take on responsibility for another one of these centers. And his reaction, although I wasn't there, well, if this was exactly his reaction, is, well, don't we already have a center in human research development or something like that? And, you know, why would we want to do another one of these? Well, so there was, and I think in the end he kind of came around and was willing to support it up to a certain point, but the support was kind of lukewarm. And then, you know, the issue, the symbolic issue of the resources that had been attached to it became important. And, you know, unless you can move that $300,000 or whatever it is across the road, and, you know, the money is so small, it is so in you know, from a you know, any kind of economic perspective, it's totally unimportant. But it became important in terms of the symbolism of the thing. The business school, and it was important in the sense that the business school already had an operating deficit at that point in time.
Yeah.
So they had to be doing something about their budget. So to take on an additional responsibility and you know, to do that without even the symbolic transfer of $300,000, that's a lot to ask.
Yes.
Really a lot to ask. And, you know, frankly, my position was this money doesn't belong to letters and science. It doesn't belong to letters. This is an obligation of the university. And, you know, what we needed there is we needed somebody at the top level of the university to broker this and say, look, this program is important. We need to keep it going. You're not interested in it anymore. Suppose Phil Certain is right. There are no faculty in letters and science who are interested in this. Well, if that's true, it's not true that there are no faculty within the university who are interested. Okay? So let's move it somewhere where it has the opportunity to be you know, rebuilt and to flourish again. So I mean, this at least was our analysis.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
best chance of that happening, you know, we explored La Follette for a period of time, but the best chance in the end became the business school. Okay, so all it would have taken was some intervention by John Wiley or Catherine Lyle. And, you know, the response we got back, I take it at face value, the response we got back is, you know, this is a decision of the Dean of Letters and Science.
And then Spear was fairly new.
Right. Oh, yeah, well, I wasn't aware of that, but right. So he's naturally going to he needs to do two things to establish himself. He's got to be tough on his budget issues, and he needs to support his deans.
That's right.
And, you know, we couldn't mobilize enough pressure to move them off that position.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think my assessment was that there was good pressure from the alumni,
yeah.
that there was good pressure from some of the constituent communities, mm. although I got to say the management community was a little wimpy.
Yeah.
In part because I think they have interests in other interests
sure.
in terms of their relationship with the university. Yeah. The labor movement, I thought, came through pretty
yeah.
well.
Now, one thing Halaby told me, and this is public, I interviewed him.
Yeah.
He said that when it came right down to it, Speer asked him to see these letters.
Yeah.
And he said there was only a handful of them, a dozen or so.
Well, I
And he said that, you know, it was hardly persuasive. I just throw that
yeah,
out.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how many of them ended
yeah.
up on his desk,
yeah.
but I got more than a dozen
yeah.
copies
yeah.
that people sent.
Yeah.
So I, you know, and, it, and I don't know at what point he's making his count
yeah.
of a dozen. There were certainly
yeah.
more than a dozen letters,
yeah.
and there were some from some fairly influential people.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know,
yeah.
take that for what you
yeah.
what it's
well,
worth.
Halaby might not know who's influential among these letters anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the perspective of a successful sociologist, I guess. You know, who are
yeah.
these people?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas you know who they are because
yeah.
you're interacting.
Yeah, these
with
are
them
important
all the time.
Public people with important public
mm-hmm.
careers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I guess it's a matter of perspective.
Yeah.
And but at any rate, I think my interpretation of Halaby's answer is they didn't generate enough pressure, and he's right about that.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't generate enough
yeah.
pressure. You know, Chuck was not a player in this.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's right.
He's just not a player at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, it may have irked him a little bit that we bypassed him, but that
yeah.
was the right decision.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No. And, right. In fact, bypassing certain was the right decision.
Yeah. Right.
Because, you know, they weren't going to, they obviously were not going to cooperate. They weren't going to transfer
mm-hmm.
this money. They weren't going to make this easy.
Mm-hmm.
And we needed the top administration
yeah.
of the university and of the Madison campus. And, you know, we didn't get to them.
Yeah.
I mean, I these people are progressive people.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the problem here is the decline and the transformation of American liberalism. You know, we have a whole generation of progressive liberal people in institutions like the university who have no direct experience with the labor movement,
yeah.
who believe that the labor movement is essentially a irrelevant social
yeah.
force. And so, unlike the 50s and 60s, where there's a much closer relationship
right.
between, you know, sort of mainstream
mm-hmm.
middle-class liberals
mm-hmm.
and
right.
the labor movement, and it may be a suspicious and a tense
right.
one, but at least there's a relationship
yeah.
there. By 2002, 2003, when
mm-hmm.
these decisions are being made, that linkage
yeah.
is not there anymore. I don't think it was there for Speer and for Ward
no.
and for Catherine Law.
And years ago on the Regents, you always had two or three labor
people. And we still
people.
Did. We still did.
But now it's down to one or two.
It's one.
One.
And it's, you know, there are a long string of Republican appointees.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The
right.
Republican
yeah.
strategy is to appoint the person from the labor movement who,
yeah.
you know,
least
likely to come to the meetings,
yeah.
basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
yeah.
And there Whereas years ago, like Frederick,
you know,
he was devoted.
He, and
yeah.
there, you know, Bert McNamara
yeah,
from the steel
exactly,
workers,
right.
and we had some strong advocates
yeah. Yeah.
For the labor education, for industrial relations,
right.
for looking at, you know,
yeah.
advocating for research that's of interest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think in some ways that you have to see this as part of, in the broader context
yeah.
of,
right.
The decline in the political and economic power of the labor movement,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and the
oh, very clearly
the essentially the how do I state this the university in general as an institution, not just the University of Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
but the university community broadly
right.
becoming less and less responsive
right.
to not just to the labor movement, but to concerns of working,
mm-hmm.
working class people
mm-hmm.
in general,
mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so, you know, in that sense, this is part of something which is much broader than what went on
yeah.
at the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
on the other hand, this should never have happened here. It should never have happened given the traditions in this university, mm-hmm. given the traditions in this state.
Now, what's happening elsewhere? I guess at Berkeley and UCLA, their labor education money was cut out of the budget.
Cut, put back, yeah. You know, I don't know where they stand yeah. right now. So a lot of it came back, I think, yeah. so the programs were saved.
Yeah.
In labor education, they were in a period similar to industrial relations in the sense that a lot of these programs are under attack, and for the same reasons, for the same mm-hmm. broader social reasons that industrial relations had problems.
Now, have you written anywhere about this?
No.
You ought to.
Maybe someday when I have a little time to kind of sit.
Well, that's right. No, I know you're very busy.
Yeah, I am, and I've been working on a book on gain sharing.
Mm-hmm.
Finished it last year with Donald Kim, and so that was. I have a limited time to write.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And lots of projects, lots of potentially mm-hmm. interesting projects.
Mm-hmm.
I put a fair amount of energy into doing what I could to save industrial relations.
Yeah. No,
and then at some point, it was a lost cause.
Yeah,
and
right. You have to cut.
I cold turkeyed at that point, basically. I cut my losses. Yeah.
No, understandable.
Which is not to say that I don't feel passionately about
mm-hmm.
what happened, because
mm-hmm.
I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad you're doing this project. I,
mm-hmm.
I really am. Because I think this is an extremely important story.
Well, I agree, and nobody else seemed to be care or do anything about it. And then I heard it somehow, you know, entered my consciousness probably in the spring when I guess I knew it was going to be closed, but
mm-hmm.
something triggered it. And so I began thinking, well, gee, you know, there's money that Jerry Summers and his fund, and so what's going to happen to all of this? And, and what's going to happen to the portraits on the wall? And, you know, will the archives get this stuff? And so on. So I began, you know, making contacts with people to make sure that something happened, and then I thought, well, gee, the story needs to be told somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And the one way to do it is oral history. Even if I never write anything,
mm-hmm.
it would be out there, and
in
other people could come and look
important.
At it.
Yeah,
right.
So I want to just comment, since you raised the funds, the trust funds, it was shameful what happened, at least my understanding of what happened to them. They basically just squandered the money. They spent it. They, you know, they supported graduate students. They had Don Schwab, I think, teach a class that had three or four people in it, you know.
Yeah.
And so basically, the deal was, as I see it, as long as there's money out there, there's a chance of reviving this thing. So the best thing we can do is spend off this money, and let's spend it in a creative way.
Yeah.
Let's spend it on people who are potentially in opposition to this decision, and I mean, this is a cynical perspective,
perspective,
but the pattern fits, let me put it that way.
Yeah.
You know, so they ended up supporting a couple of PhD students, teaching
a
couple of classes that I'm sure people could have found substitutes for elsewhere in the university.
Yeah. But it was the money that was there to pay these people, otherwise where would the money have come from? So they believe the summer
Well, yeah, they killed two birds with one stone.
It's down to 4,000.
Yeah, they killed two birds with one stone.
Yeah.
You look at these funds, each one of these funds has a mission statement, has a statement on how the money is supposed to be spent. I don't think, you know, paying operating costs of closing this department out is in any of those statements. Now, I didn't have access to the funds, so I can't testify to that, but I think that's worth a little investigation.
Yeah, no, good point.
And the other thing I want to say is thank you very much for the poster.
Oh,
you see where we
yes,
got it.
Wonderful.
And it belongs here.
Yes, good.
Yeah,
good. Actually, I've been trying to give away a few other ones to the Pyle Center, and the guy said, yeah, they'd love it, but they want a little write-up about it. And so I've written up something, and so I'll get a copy.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah.
We put a little plaque up beside
right,
it or something.
Yeah,
yeah, that'd be perfect.
Good.
Yeah, we get people. I mean, it's in a good position. Everybody
mm-hmm.
who comes in is going to see it.
Yeah.
So if we had something like that, that would
good.
Be quite helpful.
Good.
Yeah.
Have you heard about Dale Bellman?
No.
He knows the Institute's closing. He's at Michigan State.
Right.
And it works out that David Sapos was a great grand uncle or something. Sepas was his great
grand uncle. Yeah.
Some relationship. And he knew that there's the bust of Sepas in the office. And so he wondered if they could borrow it sort of permanently for an exhibit they're putting up on IR. So I talked with Hal and various other people. And my view is, let's just give it to them.
Right.
You know, nobody knows who the guy is around here. If it fit in over there, fine. So he's going to come and pick it up sometime later in the month of September.
That's good.
But what more fitting place for it? Because, you know, once it closes up, where's John R. Palman's portrait going to be?
Yeah.
You know, who knows? It'll be in the archives somewhere.
You can move anything like that down here, I think.
Well, I'll tell you,
this is not the greatest place for it.
But well, but that would be a possibility.
At least we could keep it alive until there's
appropriate place. Let's continue to think about that.
Sure.
Maybe later on we can. Because I'm working with Bernie out there at the archives in Barry Taker. But yeah, this would be...
Better to have it more accessible than to put it in a box somewhere, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Now, let's see. Anything else that needs to be covered? I think you've been very eloquent in what you've said and very insightful. Very good. Maybe I should try to get transcript of what you said typed up for you so you could do some editing and write something up on this.
Sure.
This history, the way I conceive of it, we had this Amy Eaton or Amy something or other, Freed, did this write-up of each successive directive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been trying to think of what to do, and I think it would be good to continue that. And so we would then have something on Craig Olson and I guess Dick Miller again and Paula, etc. And that would run that out. Then I would see maybe I would write an essay kind of assessing the whole thing. And after talking with you, it occurs to me maybe we need to get a couple